Well, good morning. It's always good to be in the Lord's house. Amen?
Amen.
And it's good to be with you this morning. I want to go a little bit different direction than probably some of you are accustomed to. We, over the years, have heard a lot about Martin Luther King Jr., but very few of us understand how he got involved in the civil rights movement and how God used him as a catalyst for change. A few years ago, I started looking at the life of Dr. King and discovered that he told his own story. He tells his own story. And that if we just looked at some of his writings, his teachings, his preaching, his famous sermons, we could gain an insight. So today I'm going to do two excerpts from Dr. King's material. The first one is a sermon entitled, Why Jesus Called a Man a Fool. It was a sermon that he preached at Mount Pisgah Missionary Baptist Church on August 27th, 1967. And I just want to share a small part of that because it tells of his getting involved in the civil rights struggle. And then I want to conclude by sharing a second piece, which is called I've Been to the Mountaintop, which was delivered the night before Dr. King was assassinated. It was his last public address. So right now, Why Jesus Called a Man a Fool by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Now, of course, I was religious. I grew up in the church. I'm the son of a preacher. I'm the great-grandson of a preacher. I'm the great-great-grandson of a preacher. My father is a preacher. My grandfather was a preacher. My great-grandfather was a preacher. My only brother is a preacher. My daddy's brother is a preacher. So I didn't have much choice, I guess. But I'd grown up in the church, and the church meant something very real to me. But it was kind of an inherited religion, and I had never felt an experience with God in the way that you must have it if you're going to walk the lonely paths of this life. Everything was done, and if I ever had a problem, I could always call Daddy, my earthly father, and things were solved. But one day after finishing school, I was called to a little church down in Montgomery, Alabama. I started preaching there. Things were going well. But one day, a year later, a lady by the name of Rosa Parks decided that she couldn't take it any longer, and she stayed in a bus seat. You may not remember it now because it's way back several years, but it was the beginning of a movement where 50,000 black men and women refused absolutely to ride the city buses. And we walked together for 381 days. That's what we've got to learn in the North. Negroes have to learn to stick together. We stuck together. We sent out the call and no Negro rode the buses. It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. And then the people of Montgomery asked me to serve as the spokesman and the president of the new organization, the Montgomery Improvement Association. And I couldn't say no. And so we started our struggle together. Things were going well for the first few days, but then about 10 or 15 days later, after the white people in Montgomery knew that we meant business, they started doing some nasty things. They started making some nasty telephone calls. And it got to the point that some days more than 40 telephone calls would come in, threatening my life, the life of my family, the life of my children. I took it for a while in a strong manner. But I never will forget one night very late. It was around midnight. And you can have some strange experiences at midnight. I came home and my wife was in bed and I immediately crawled into bed to get some rest. to get up early the next morning to try and keep things going. Immediately, the telephone started ringing, and I picked it up. And on the other end was an ugly voice. And that voice said to me in substance, "Nigger, we're tired of you and your mess now. And if you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow your brains out and blow up your house." I'd heard these kind of things before, but for some reason that night, it got to me. I turned over and I tried to go to sleep, but I couldn't sleep. I was frustrated. I was bewildered. And then I got up and I went back to the kitchen and I started warming me some coffee, thinking that coffee would give me a little relief. I started thinking about many things. I pulled back on the theology and the philosophy that I had just studied in the universities, trying to give philosophical and theological reasons for the existence of sin and evil, but the answer didn't quite come there. I sat there and thought about a beautiful little daughter who had just been born about a month earlier. We have 4 children now, but we only had the 1 then. She was the darling of my life. I'd come in night after night and see that little gentle smile, and I sat at that table thinking that she could be taken away from me at any moment. I started thinking about a dedicated, devoted, and loyal wife who was over there asleep. I could be taken from her, or she could be taken from me, and I got to the point that I couldn't take it any longer. I was weak. Something said to me, "You can't call on Daddy now. He's up in Atlanta, 175 miles away. You can't even call on Mama now, but you've got to call on that something and that person that your daddy used to tell you about. That power that can make a way out of no way." And I discovered then that I had to know God for myself, and religion had to become real to me. And I bowed down over that cup of coffee, and I never will forget it. And oh yes, I prayed a prayer. And I prayed out loud that night. I said, "Lord, I'm down here trying to do what's right. I think I'm right, and I think the cause we represent is right. But Lord, I must confess that I'm weak now. I'm faltering. I'm losing my courage. And I can't let the people see me like this, because if they see me weak and losing my courage, they will begin to get weak." And it seemed at that moment that I could hear an inner voice speaking to me and saying to me, "Martin Luther, stand up for righteousness. Martin Luther, stand up for justice. Stand up for truth, and lo, I will be with you always, even to the end of the world." And I'll tell you, I've seen the lightning flash. I've heard the thunder roll. I've felt sin breakers dashing, trying to conquer my soul. But I heard the voice of Jesus saying, "Still to fight on." He promised never to leave me alone. Never to leave me alone. No, never alone. He promised never to leave me alone. And I'm going on in believing in him. You'd better know him and know how to call his name. Don't be a fool. Recognize your dependence on God. Centuries ago, Jeremiah raised a question. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? He raised it because he saw the good people suffering so often and the evil people prospering. Centuries later, our slave foreparents came along. They too saw the injustices of life. Had nothing to look forward to morning after morning but the rawhide whip of the overseer, long rows of cotton in the sizzling heat. But they did an amazing thing. They looked back
across the centuries, and they took Jeremiah's question mark and they straightened it into an exclamation point. And they came with a beautiful song that said, "There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole." Yes, there's a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. And there's another stanza that I like so well. "Sometimes I feel discouraged." And I don't mind telling you this morning that sometimes I feel discouraged. I felt discouraged in Chicago. As I move throughout Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, I feel discouraged sometimes. Living every day under the threat of death, I feel discouraged. Living every day under extensive criticisms, even from Negroes, sometimes I feel discouraged and feel my works in vain. But then the Holy Spirit revives my soul again. There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. This last excerpt that I would like to do was given the night before he was assassinated. Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King had gone there to help rally support for striking sanitation workers. The address is titled, "I've Been to the Mountaintop," April 3rd, 1968, Memphis, Tennessee. "Thank you very kindly, my friends. As I listened to Ralph Abernathy in his eloquent and generous introduction and then thought about myself, I wondered who he was talking about. But it's always good to have your closest friend and associate to say something good about you. And Ralph Abernathy is the best friend that I have in the world. Now, I'm delighted to see each of you here in spite of a storm warning. You reveal that you are determined to go on anyhow. Something is happening in Memphis. Something is happening in our world. And you know, if I was standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, 'Martin Luther King, which age would you like to live in?' I would take my mental flight by Egypt. And I would watch God's children and their magnificent trip across the Red Sea and through the wilderness and on towards the Promised Land. But in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. I would move on by Greece. And there I would take my mind up to Mount Olympus. And I would see Plato and Aristotle, Socrates, Euripides, and Aristophanes as they assembled around the Parthenon. And I would watch them around the Parthenon as they discussed the great and eternal issues of reality, but I wouldn't stop there. I would go on even to the great heyday of the Roman Empire. And I would see various developments through various emperors and leaders, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the day of the Renaissance and get a quick picture of all that the Renaissance did for the cultural and aesthetic life of man, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even go by way for the man for whom I am named had his habitat. And I would watch Martin Luther as he tacked his 95 theses on the door of the church at Wittenberg, but I wouldn't stop there. I would come on up even to 1863 and watch a vacillating president by the name of Abraham Lincoln finally come to the conclusion that he had to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, but I wouldn't stop there. I would come on up even to the early 30s and see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation and hear him come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. But I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you just allow me to live a few more years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. Now, that's a strange statement to make because the world is messed up. The nation is sick, trouble in the land, confusion all around. That's a strange statement, but I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in some strange way that men are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up. And wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free. And another reason that I'm happy to live in this period is that we've been forced to a point where we're going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with throughout history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with them. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but no longer can we just talk about it. It is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are tonight. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and we drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. As soon as we got on that road, I turned and I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus uses this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, some 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. And in the days of Jesus, it became known as the Bloody Pass. You know, it's quite possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking, that he was acting like he had been hurt and robbed in order to seize them over there, to lure them there for quick and easy seizure. So the first question that the priest asks, the first question that the Levite asked is, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came along and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? And that's the question before you tonight. The question is not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to the long hours I spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to me? But the question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. So let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination. And let us move on in these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be. And we have the opportunity to make America a better nation. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. While sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "You Martin Luther King Jr.?" And I was looking down writing at the time and I said yes. The next thing I knew, I felt something beating on my chest. And before I realized that I had been stabbed by this demented woman, I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was at the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you drown in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after my operation, after my chest had been opened up and the blade had been taken out, they allowed me to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital and to read some of the mail that came in from all over the states and all over the world. Kind letters came in. I received one from the president and one from the vice president, but I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I received a letter and a visit from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what his letter said, but there was another letter. It came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And as I looked at that letter, I never shall forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King," she said, "I'm a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School. And while it should not matter, I would like to mention the fact that I am a white girl." She said, "I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. I read that if you had merely sneezed, you would have died. And I'm writing simply to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze." Now, I want to say tonight that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze. Because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best of the American dream and taking our whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep in the founding fathers, in the Constitution, and in the Declaration of Independence. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here to 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when the Negroes of Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they're going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1963 when the black people of Birmingham, Alabama aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around later that year in August to try and tell America about a dream that I'd had. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama to see the great movement there. And if I had sneezed, I wouldn't be here in Memphis to see a community rally around brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, "Now it doesn't matter now. It doesn't really matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot came over the public address, and he said, 'We're sorry for the delay, but we have Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on board, and to be sure that all the bags were checked and to be sure that nothing would go wrong on the plane, we've had it secure and guarded all night.' And then I got into Memphis, and some began to talk about or say the threats that were out, about what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I'd like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I might not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.